This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. A recent survey by the Roy Morgan Organisation found that as little as 11% of Australians found journalists to be ethical or honest. Thank goodness I'm not one. Accountants, union leaders and bank managers all rated higher. We in Australia would like to think that we have a free press, but at the moment, the organisation Reporters Without Borders ranked Australia at number 26 out of 180 countries as a measure of press freedom. So maybe that's okay, but still, down at number 26, we were ahead of the UK, the US, that's something. In a time when impartial information has never been more important, people are more and more likely to get their news from partisan sources or even from social media platforms with no editorial policies or journalistic rigour. This morning for our talking point, we're going to be discussing the history of journalism, the current state of the profession, and what the future holds for this industry. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Muller. He's a leading expert on media ethics, is backed by 27 years of experience as a journalist, including assistant editor at the Sydney Morning Herald, associate editor at The Age. He currently teaches at Melbourne University. I think he worked at The Times as well and is an honorary fellow at the Centre for Advancing Journalism. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rod.
Some say we live in a post-truth world. Are we now living, do you think, in a post-journalism world?
No, I don't think we are. But I think in your introduction, you made a couple of very pertinent points about that. I think a useful place to start might be to say, well, what is journalism? Because in your introduction, you mentioned Twitter and you mentioned the ability of everybody around the world, if they want to get on their computer and do what looks like journalism, but isn't always. Because journalism, I think, can be defined by the promises it makes to society. Promises about prior verification of facts. That's to say, verification before you publish. Promise about impartiality. You mentioned that a minute ago. Really important. Promises about getting material from authoritative sources and checking it out before broadcast or publication. So these are the promises that journalism makes. And unless the material that's coming out of Twitter or people's computers keeps those promises, then I don't think you can call it journalism.
Next week on the program, we're going to talk about Julian Assange. But I just want to pick up on what you said there, because people talk about him as being a kind of an assault on a free press. But what he did with that WikiLeaks dump of information was not really journalism. He just put it all out there without curating it in any way, really.
That's exactly right. And I think that's a very important point. Julian Assange is not a journalist. He's a source for journalists. He's a publisher, certainly, because he published that stuff on WikiLeaks, but he published it in a way which was not journalistic. The people who published the journalistic stuff were The Guardian and The New York Times and the German newspaper Der Spiegel, who took Assange as a source and took his material as source material and then did some very important things. And the most important thing they did was to go through it, make a selection based on news values, and then to redact or to eliminate content which would have had a tendency to identify the sources, the original sources of the material, to the American security services, because, of course, the people who did that were in mortal danger. And Assange didn't seem to care about that. He just dumped the documents. But the newspapers, they did care very much about it, and so they very carefully edited and redacted that in order to minimise the risk of harm, which is yet another of the promises that journalism makes. So you're quite right, Assange is not a journalist, but he is a publisher, and it's because of his work as a publisher that we can talk about him in relation to the freedom of the press.
Okay. What do you think about the term citizen journalist?
Well, it's a useful term for people who aren't employed by big media organisations, but who actually do journalism, who keep those promises I was talking about. There's quite a few of them. Some of them very useful. I do quite a lot of work for the conversation. Sometimes if I write, for example, on public opinion polls, then I'll be drawing on a character called Mumbrella, who is a citizen journalist, but a very good analyst of public opinion polls. And I would certainly classify the character behind the Mumbrella name as a citizen journalist. But a citizen journalist does not simply produce gossip or unverified material or a lot of the kind of stuff that we see on social media, which is really no more than what people would have been putting in private letters years and years ago. So again, it depends on whether what they do is journalism.
Okay. So there are more and more journalists in media and communications courses than ever before in Australia. What are they being taught? And was it better in the old days? Might hear that a few times this morning. When, if you wanted to become a journalist, you were a cadet. You went to work at a newspaper, or you went to work at a TV station or a radio station. You began as a cadet. You worked your way through 3 or 4 years until finally you were graded as a journalist. That, I don't know whether that still happens. Do people still get cadetships?
I dare say they do, but it's a pretty rare thing these days. I grew up through journalism in just the way you've described. I left school on Friday and I started at my local suburban newspaper the following Monday. I had no formal training in journalism at all. And the answer to your first question was that better? Well, the answer is a resounding no. It was certainly not better. Because although you learned all of the practical skills and learnt them quite well and quite quickly, you were nonetheless not equipped to question the way things were done. You basically just did what you were told, and you did it without much thought, except insofar as the thought was needed to make you do it well. But you didn't really question why you did it or how you did it. And I think that the current generation of journalists, and they've more or less all been through some sort of university course, need to be a journalism one, have been taught to think for themselves in a way that we certainly weren't. We were children, basically. Yeah. And so we were taught according pretty much to the lights of the organisation that we were working for. I happened to work for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age for a long time. I worked for a short time on The Times and Financial Times. But I kind of imbibed their cultures. And I might easily have imbibed another culture if I'd worked, for example, on the News of the World. So, yes, we got the skills, but we didn't really get the depth of thinking that would have enabled us to use those skills more effectively, I think.
So one of the interesting things I've noticed about people who are doing communications courses, and I had this very conversation with someone once, that they didn't know, once they finished, whether they wanted to be a journalist or work in PR, as if the two things were the same. Quite often these media and communications courses teach you how to work in public relations. Now, surely that is a very different thing. In PR, you're trying to get your message across without it being looked at particularly closely or scrutinised, and in journalism that's the opposite.
Yes, well, they're two sides of the same coin, really, aren't they? And so the skills that you get from learning about how to do journalism equip you, if you're going to do the other thing, to manipulate the journalist. And that's been a feature, I think, of life as a journalist for a very long time. It's got an awful lot worse because what we now have, and have had for a long time, is that a situation in which the public relations people vastly outnumber the number of journalists. I mean, when I was chief of staff of the Sydney Morning Herald in the 1970s, I would be inundated every morning with piles of handouts from the public relations industry, and most of it just went straight into the bin. But the point is that these days, on top of corporate PR, what we've now got is layer upon layer of spin doctors and PR people, particularly in politics, so that getting access to the actual people in power, particularly the ministers, is now extremely difficult. So I think the real problem is not so much that they learn the skills of journalism and then, in a sense, turn them on their head as PR people, but it's been this extraordinary burst of or expansion of the PR trade, which has now meant that the people in power are far less accountable than they used to be.
So when we talk about that, though, it's the sophistication of it that is a concern, in that it's not just writing a press release and have that published in the paper, which we see on Media Watch nearly every week, and they just change the byline and the headline, perhaps, and then just reproduce what the PR company has given them. And, you know, that's what they do occasionally or quite often. But on, say, commercial TV news, on the major bulletins, if people still watch them at night, 6 o'clock at night, 7 o'clock on the ABC, these PR companies will provide the guest, the talent, if they're trying to push something in particular. They will even do the interview and just provide that to the TV stations themselves.
They do, and what they're doing in that is exploiting the hollowing out of newsrooms that's come about since about 2006, when the internet began to drain away significant amounts of the revenue that keeps journalism going. And so not just in television bulletins, but particularly in regional newspapers, where the impact of this has been horrendous, editors and news directors are taking this stuff, I think, unconscionably, and just reproducing it as if it were journalism, which it simply, certainly is not. I mean, there's been no independent checking of any of this stuff. A lot of it is merely advertising dressed up as news, what's called hybrid journalism, a ghastly term, but that's ubiquitous now. And that is public relations on steroids, because the draining away of the revenue, the hollowing out of newsrooms, has left smaller organisations in particular desperate for stuff to fill their pages or fill their bulletins. And so, yes, what you're seeing is PR exploiting this rundown in journalistic resources.
Dennis Muller is our guest. So you talk about you starting on suburban papers. Now, COVID and obviously what happened with that gave a lot of these newspaper companies, and a lot of them, for example, suburban free papers, throwaways, were owned by News Limited anyway. They decided to close them down because they couldn't afford to run them during COVID. In the end, in Sydney, for example, which is a big city of, you know, millions of people, you might have now only three or four suburban newspapers, and they are only there basically to sell real estate. So what about the future of suburban papers? Will they ever come back, or is that it forever, or have they just been usurped by various Facebook pages?
No, I don't think they've been usurped by Facebook pages, but whether they come back is very much an open question. I think the impact in big cities like Sydney and Melbourne has been bad enough, but it's been worse by far in regional Australia, and that was not assisted by the ill-directed assistance to the media given by the previous government. They put out an assistance package in the middle of COVID designed to help regional newspapers stay afloat. Unfortunately, they directed the vast majority of that money to the big players, to Australian Community Media, ACM, or to News Corporation, or to the television networks, who did nothing at all to increase the number of journalists or to make news more local, when they should have sent the money to the independent operators in country towns and cities who've got a long-standing connection and commitment to their community. So the result was, as you've described, a wholesale closure of titles, even by those big organisations who received the bulk of the government money. So I suppose the question that runs on from that is there a role for government in helping to keep alive some of these papers. And I think the answer to that is unquestionably yes.
Okay, but how does that happen? Because it is a free market, and the papers would be, yes, everyone would like, well, the newspapers or local TV or radio, for that matter, would want some government support if they got it, but some get it, some don't. How would the government have to prop up every local media outlet in the country?
No, I don't think so. I think we're talking more about tax relief. We're talking more about tax incentives to businesses to advertise locally. We're not really talking about government grants, but there's been quite a lot of work done on this issue by a series of government inquiries, Senate inquiries mainly, to try to find a way in which this can be done without, of course, just relying on government handouts, but at the same time providing at least enough money to keep them going. And these small organisations, they don't need to answer to the stock exchange with huge amounts of profits. They just need enough money to keep themselves going. They're content with that on the whole. But the mechanism for getting this done is still very much an open question.
Our guest this morning is Dennis Muller, and as you heard, he worked at the Herald in the 70s, worked briefly at the Times, he's now an academic. Why do journalists or reporters have such bad reputations? Why is it that only 11% of the population trust them, Dennis?
Oh, Rod, you open a large and difficult question. When I announced to my father that I was going to become a journalist, he was horrified. He said, "A journalist? They're all just drunkards and liars." That was in about 1967 or something. And I think that stereotype has been very deeply embedded in our culture for a long, long time. Why? Well, look, we played fast and loose with the public trust for centuries, really. I mean, you go right back to the end of the 19th century with the industrialization of the press, you know, the steam press, mechanized typesetting, and you had tremendous circulation wars, particularly in places like New York, where the truth didn't really matter. And so I think we, as a profession, and as the media as an industry, sold out on the public trust somewhere around about the turn of the 20th century, the 19th, 20th centuries, and we've never regained it. Once you sell out on the public trust, people are very reluctant to reinvest. And yet, you know, the paradox is that when people see really excellent journalism of the kind that is done by Four Corners every week, by the kind that we see Nick McKenzie and his investigative team doing on The Age, people do realise and do value what journalism is. But journalism as a whole, as a profession, and the media as an industry, do have a very grubby reputation, largely of their own making.
Let's take some calls on this. Robin is first in the UK. G'day, Robin.
Rod, good morning to you and your guest. Sorry, I don't know your guest name.
Our guest is Dennis.
Dennis, hello, Dennis. I'm ex-commercial radio, mostly in the UK, which was a phone-in talk station, but it gave me a taste of journalism. And like you, Rod, I consider myself, if anything, a broadcaster or broadcast engineer and never a journalist, because I feel that journalism in its own little way has killed itself with its arrogance and its aggression towards people, especially the right-wing media. And what we're seeing now, especially with TikTok and other sort of communication forms, is more people just giving it a go when they actually know in their hearts they've got a story they need to get out. And what you said at the top of the hour, Rod, is absolutely true. Journalism has changed, and it's going to be very interesting in the next 30 years, I think.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Robin. So journalism in the UK, dominated by, well, what we see anyway, Dennis, dominated by newspapers, often known as red tops, and dominated by Rupert Murdoch. Why is it so bad in the UK, do you think, Dennis?
Well, the UK is both fortunate and unfortunate in this. It's unfortunate in that Rupert Murdoch is by far the single most powerful media owner in the country. He not only owns the Red Tops, the Sun and the Sunday Sun, but, of course, also the Times and the Sunday Times. So at both ends of the market, And he's wielded enormous influence over a whole succession of prime ministers, going right back to Margaret Thatcher. That's the unfortunate side of the British media. The fortunate side, however, is that in The Observer and The Guardian and in the BBC, they have at the high end some of the best journalism in the world. So it's a very mixed picture in the UK. And of course, they've got more, not a lot more, but certainly more voices, a greater variety and diversity of media owners than we have here. We've basically got three main voices: News Corporation, the Nine Entertainment Organisation, which now runs the old Fairfax newspapers, and the ABC. So, then of course, Rupert Murdoch dominates the newspaper industry here. He controls about two-thirds of the metropolitan daily newspaper circulation, and he's got monopolies in Brisbane, Adelaide, and Hobart. So, the balance of power in the Australian media is very skewed.
Let's go to Jan now. Good morning, Jan.
G'day. Thank you, Dennis. I'm loving the commentary, but I'd like to take... I've missed a little bit talking to your producer, but I'd like to take Dennis's timeline back to earlier with regarding the mistrust and distrust of journalists. It goes right back to the 1900s when they just filled up all sorts of inches with print of gossip and untrue things. But in my lifetime, in the 70s, Maxwell Newton did a lot to damage journalists when he published gossip and the racing results. And the truth was, Maxwell Newton did the Melbourne Observer, and I don't know whether Dennis remembers. Oh, he should. He's the right age, okay. I think, to remember these publications.
Yeah. All right.
But they published all sorts of gossip that was not verified, in fact.
Okay. All right, Dennis, any comments on what Jan was saying?
Yes, I mean, Jan's right. They did. They published a lot of salacious gossip, much of it, out of the divorce courts before the Family Law Act of 1973 outlawed that. But so in addition to publishing a lot of gossip, they published a lot of material that was harmful to, you know, innocent, suffering people who were going through public divorces. But the truth, it ought to be also remembered, in Melbourne, was the newspaper that revealed the abortion rackets that led to a royal commission into police corruption. So even the truth, from time to time, did really good journalism, but there's no doubt that they did an awful lot of harm as well. And I think Jan's absolutely right. The mistrust goes right back, as I was saying before, to the sort of end of the 19th century. And although efforts were made in the 1940s, immediately after the Second World War, to remedy this by the introduction of proper codes of ethics and standards of impartiality, the mistrust lingers, and it's not to be wondered at.
So that appears to have changed, and two texts that have come in, and please join us on the text, 0467 922 702. Paper Chucker, who delivers papers, he says, I think most people see journalists as editorialists as opposed to telling the actual story. And another texter says, I think Rupert has had a lot to do with the public's view of journalism. So what we have seen, certainly in the last 20 years, maybe more than that, last 30 years, is big-selling tabloid papers like the Telegraph in Sydney and the Herald Sun in Melbourne, to a lesser extent, I suppose, the Courier Mail in Brisbane, but all those Murdoch papers, they have in some ways stopped reporting the news and started becoming advocates for issues, or treating the news in an not in an impartial way. And we also see that on, Sky After Dark, another of Rupert's ventures. So these days, newspapers and TV channels are more likely to be partisan or have an agenda. How does that affect the news?
Well, it distorts the news. That's the fundamental problem, because it presents the news in a way which is not slanted in the way that I mean, all news to some extent has got a slant on it. Of course, it's what we call the angle. The way into a news story is to start with what we think is the most interesting point. But this is a different kind of slant. This is slanted for political purposes, and it is both a cause and a symptom of the high partisanship that we've seen in the United States, in Britain, and here. And it's not a coincidence that in each of those three democracies, Rupert Murdoch is a dominant media player. So it's he, in the same way that the PR industry exploited the rundown of the of newsrooms, so Rupert Murdoch has exploited the atmosphere of partisanship and populism, which has been a feature of global politics in the West for what? The better part of 15 years? And so what he has done is to turbocharge this partisanship. And in doing so, I think what he's trying to do is exploit the partisanship that we see online. Some of the most successful, if you want to call them that, people online are the hyper-partisans, the people who run the echo chambers and the filter bubbles. And I think what Murdoch has done is to see an opportunity here to create in broadcasting and in print, in television in particular, and in print, a kind of hyper-partisan series of media platforms to compete with the hyper-partisan platforms online. So I think there's no question that the newspapers you mentioned now produce a brand of news which really is only news in appearance. It's really, as you say, advocacy and hyper-partisan politics.
So why do people keep buying it then?
Because I think they're entertained by it to some extent, and I think the other thing is that who buys it is a good question. I suspect that, in fact, the people who buy it are people whose own views are reinforced by what they read. And I think that's true, not just, to be honest, of the right. I think that's true also of the centre and the centre-left. So people tend, I think, in this partisan age, to choose the media which very much fits with their own worldview to a greater extent, I think, than they ever did in the past.
So where does Sky After Dark fit in that, given that very, very few people actually watch it? We've seen it drop down below 30,000 people most nights, and that is hyper-partisan, as you've been saying. What's the point of continuing with that when so few people actually want to watch it?
Well, because it gets advertising, and it does. Its TV audience in some ways is not its most important audience. It's its online audience, and that is where the advertising revenue comes from. And what they've discovered at Sky at Night is if they can fasten on to an issue which is of interest to the Americans, their audiences skyrocket. So when, for example, the whole issue of the stolen election was being promoted on Sky at Night, which it was, just as much as it was by Fox News in America, then Sky at Night saw its audience spike. I mean, it went up by several orders of magnitude. And, of course, what that does is to attract advertising online. And so that's their game. You're quite right to say that their television audience is derisory, but that isn't really the whole story by any means. The other aspect of Sky at Night is that they are now able to broadcast not just through subscription television, but free-to-air, because they have done deals with the free-to-air television broadcasters in regional Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria that enables them to get at least some of their material out on those regional TV networks at night. So what they're doing is, of course, increasing by a small amount, but increasing their influence in regional areas.
George is with us. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Rod and Dennis. Really good discussion, I've got to say. I did work in TV and radio alongside journalists. I'm not a journalist myself, but I worked in TV news crews and so forth. So I had the opportunity to see the difference even then, back in the late 70s and down through the early 90s, of between, say, ABC journalists and commercial journalists. And the standards even then were significantly different, shall we say. But my question is in regards to academia. Now, a lot of journalists obviously require expert testimony and evidence from academia, from professors and other academics in regards to specialised issues. Now, we saw obviously within COVID recently, there's up to 40,000 jobs were lost in the academic sector because the government of the time didn't feel that that was a sector that needed to be supported as opposed to other sectors. And I just wanted to ask Dennis about the importance of academia and this hollowing out of academia, even though it was obviously COVID related, and how that might possibly affect the quality of the of journalism in terms of the support of the expert evidence, especially obviously because it's under attack from other areas, including social media, where people deny things actually exist.
Okay, thanks very much for that, George. So the future of journalism, if a lot of those teachers have been lost.
Well, there's that, and I think George's other point was that yes, there has been a dramatic reduction in academic staff across the whole of the Australian university sector, and the problem, of course, with that is that there are fewer there's less research being done, and there are fewer expert voices to call on. The university, certainly Melbourne Uni, but all of the universities, I think, take this whole issue very seriously because they understand that journalists come to them not just for expert opinion, but for opinion that's based on science and facts and research. And they don't come to us for polemics. They don't come to us for a political view on things. Sometimes what we say, particularly in areas like climate change, is then politicized by others, but the academics themselves take great care to be providing journalists with expert but impartial material. And I think that does play into the problem that we've just been speaking about, the hyper-partisanship problem, where, of course, impartiality is the first casualty. So, yes, no question that the fall-off or the hollowing out of the academy is making the hollowing out of newsrooms even worse.
Now, it's taken more than half an hour, but we've got here. Les in Brisbane says, I'm a baby boomer and a rusted-on conservative who is appalled at the bias displayed by the ABC. I expect my money spent to support the ABC to result in apolitical reporting. Instead, we have biased journalists interviewing other in-house journalists who are fellow travellers, which, during the last election, was anti-government. That's Les's view. Now, is that the case that if you read or hear or see something that you don't agree with, you immediately think that it's bias the other way?
Well, it's a natural human impulse, I think, yes. But I think the stereotype about left-wing bias in the ABC is really just that. The ABC has really very rigorous standards of journalistic requirements. I mean, they have a large tome called the editorial policies, and they're far more thorough than anything in the commercial sector. So I think the premise of the question that it's basically ABC left-wing bias is not entirely made out. Yes, of course, there's been some instances of left-wing bias. There's been some instances of right-wing bias in the ABC. But I think the fact that the ABC's level of trust among the Australian population is way, way, way ahead and above any trust in commercial media tells us that the Australian population on the whole do accept that the ABC's news coverage is impartial and can be trusted, has been properly verified. So, you know, I do a bit of broadcasting on the ABC. I'm always accused of being a left winger. I'm not really, and particularly in journalistic matters, I'm really quite a conservative. But nonetheless, because I do a bit of broadcasting on the ABC, I'm lumped in as a left winger with everybody else.
I accept what Les is saying, is that he genuinely believes that, because there is some sort of prevailing view that that's the case. I would dispute it totally. Certainly a very prominent ABC journalist hosting one of the most prominent ABC news programs is accused of supporting the former government all the time. So it's quite often, when you're watching it, if somebody does not agree, or if you don't agree with what they are saying, you think that they are biased the other way. It is something that, and Les admits, he's a rusted-on conservative. So he has views, and I question, Les, if you say you are, as you say you are, a rusted-on conservative, how open are you to seeing something the other way? So if you don't, then can you be objective in this regard? Stan says, news stories don't get time exposure, they don't get enough scrutiny, and the story fails to mature. The next tidbit of news has sprung up and needs attention before someone else breaks it. Competition beats the need for competence. Now, that is what we are seeing online, isn't it? That in the old days, I suppose in the old days where there was competition between newspapers, afternoon papers in particular, to get the story out first, that was one thing. But now it's different, because you really do need to get it out before your competitor breaks that story online. That has changed things totally, hasn't it?
Oh, it certainly has, and it's led to a terrible failure of prior verification, particularly in the first decade after the internet really exploded onto the scene. We had a situation in which even respectable newspapers were putting stuff up that they saw online, trying to keep up with this unending flood. And then, if it turned out to be wrong, they'd correct it or take it down. And it was a dreadful mantra that I began to hear in newsrooms in around about the sort of late 1990s and early 2000s. If it's wrong, it won't be wrong for long. And this proposition was that, well, we'll put it up, and if it turns out to be wrong, someone will see it, and we can either correct it or take it down. Well, I mean, that was a failure of the first requirement, which is you verify before you publish, not afterwards. And the speeded up news cycle made that worse. I think, in fact, the serious media have regained their footing in that area, and they're not now prepared to publish without prior verification. But the speeded up news cycle means simply that the media circus moves on faster than it did before. It's always moved on fairly quickly, but it's just speeded up.
In Australia, was there a golden age of journalism, do you think? And when was that, and why did it stop?
I think there was a golden age of resources for journalism, and I was a beneficiary of it. I think from about the end of the Second World War through until the onslaught of the internet in the early 2000s, I think that there was never a time when journalism was better resourced. Whether the journalism that resulted from those resources was a golden age is a very difficult question. But I think that certainly, on the whole, the resourcing did lead to, for example, the formation of investigative reporting units at The Age initially. They were the pioneers in Australia with their Insight team. Then at Four Corners. And then finally at the Sydney Morning Herald, I was the founding editor of their investigations unit. I think that we had the resources to put into that side of journalism, which had never existed before. And it's a struggle now to maintain it. They are maintaining it, all of those organisations, but there certainly was a golden age of resourcing, but I don't think that it led uniformly to a golden age of journalism.
Okay. How much longer do you think newspapers have?
How long is a piece of string? Forever, I reckon, Rod. I don't subscribe at all to the view that newspapers will die. For several reasons. The first is that even now, they have, on the whole, the largest newsrooms. The ABC, of course, is unique in this. It's got the biggest staff of journalists in the country. But In terms of individual newsrooms, it's still the newspapers who have by far the biggest ones. They still inject a huge amount of new information into the daily news cycle. But there's something more, and it's hard to put your finger on, but it's to do, I think, with their physical presence, their physicality, their visibility, the fact that you can pick them up, you can hold them, you can see them lying around the place. There's a sort of ubiquity to them. They're just there in the world. And I think that it's a mistake to think that that newspapers are going to disappear. I don't think they're going to. I really do think that they will find ways of sustaining themselves, certainly not at the level that they got used to when they had a monopoly on classified advertising. But still, I think there are lots of reasons to say that newspapers will be with us for the foreseeable future.
So that is a really important point about the lack of money coming in. The rivers of gold, as they were called, Fairfax in the 70s and 80s, with classified ads, mostly houses, jobs and cars, that's all gone online now. All that money has been lost. With TV, looking at Kerry Packer and the Nine Network, after Kerry Packer died, James Packer had no interest in running a TV station and sold it pretty quickly. And all that money that they used to make from having a dominant primetime TV coverage with advertising, that's all been lost because of the total diffusion of, you know, where we watch TV these days or online on streaming. So that's all gone as well. That's the reason it's all declined, isn't it? The money that propped it up no longer exists.
Oh, absolutely, yes. That's why the golden age is over. You know, we had this golden age, and I think it was it was beneficial, and we still benefit from the remnants of it. But there's no question that we don't have, for example, just take one simple example, anything like the same level of court reporting that we used to have. We used to have a staff, when I was in the Sydney Morning Herald of the Age, we had a staff of, you know, four or five full-time permanent court reporters. I mean, it's down to one or two now, and so we don't get that sort of coverage of a very important part of social life. We don't have anything like the resources to report on state politics or federal politics. You've seen the Nine newspapers now, the Age and Sydney Morning Herald, sharing a lot of their Canberra staff, so you don't get that variety of voice. There's no question that the golden age is over, and we are suffering the consequences, but I don't think it's going to mean in the end that that newspapers disappear.
Okay, but we are in the golden age of something else, which is the golden age of podcasting. Or maybe we're at the start of a golden age. I don't know. Maybe it's going to be even better in the future, because much of the great reporting is done on podcasts these days.
It is. Absolutely it is. So it's...
because and I say that because people still have the time to tell a good story, and they can tell it over one episode or 10 episodes. They can interview a whole lot of different people. They can tell that story in a way that people can listen to in their own time, or they wait for the next episode to drop every week. There is still a desire there, but people want to have it for nothing. That's the thing about podcasts. Generally, you're getting them for free. And this is where it comes down to the audience. The audience, which gets free from the ABC in particular, news online, and free from some newspapers online as well, they're not prepared to pay for an online presence the way they were prepared to pay for a newspaper.
Exactly. Yeah, we got into this habit very early on with the online world that there was a free lunch to be had. Well, there's no free lunch to be had, and that's been, you know, part of the problem. But I think the broader point you make about new forms of news, the podcast is a good example, does mean that that journalism, regardless of what the platform might be or the means of dissemination or distribution, it's the journalism that we need to be focusing on. We need the platforms, of course, but just because old platforms are not as strong as they used to be doesn't mean that journalism needs to be not as strong as it used to be or could be even stronger than it was. I think it's always important to keep in mind that the journalism is a profession that serves the media industry, and that it's a mistake to conflate the two so that you think that the fate of the industry is also automatically going to also be the fate of the profession. It needn't necessarily be so, and I think the podcast example is an excellent one.
So how can we encourage more people to support newspapers in particular, whether it be online or in hard copy, or even pay for their I subscribe to at least half a dozen newspapers online, and you can do that now, the international ones like the Times, the New York Times, Washington Post, as well as Australian ones as well. How can we encourage more people to do that?
I really don't know is the answer to that question, but I think we all just have to wake up to the fact that journalism is vital to democracy. If we want our democracy to be healthy, one little way that we can contribute to the health of our democracy is to be prepared to buy a subscription to the media. I mean, like you, I subscribe to half a dozen or so different newspapers. I have to, of course, for professional reasons. But really, if we want our democracy to be healthy, then one little way each of us could contribute to its health is to subscribe to a media organisation that you trust and that delivers you a good service, not just on entertainment, but good service on the sort of news you need to participate in social and political and economic life and to make your little contribution to the health of democracy, because God knows, as we've seen since 2016, you know, democracy is in a crisis and we all need to pull our weight to get it out of it.
All right. Dennis, thank you so much for your time this morning and for some valuable insights, a fascinating conversation. I appreciate it very much and thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure, Rod. Thank you.
There you go. Dennis Muller is has been our very special guest this morning.
Overnights with Rod Quinn
on ABC Radio.